For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow, Thursday and Friday, we have all new morning shows for you. But today's program is spent in the morning show archives with two really interesting morning show interviews from the past. The first was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2009. Well, if you are even in the situation that I am and have never held a cigarette to your lips in all your life, nonetheless, you might really find quite fascinating a book which I have been reading with great interest called The Cigarette Century, the rise, fall, and deadly persistence of the product that defined America. In it, history professor Alan Brandt, history of medicine professor Alan Brandt at the Harvard Medical School, has written a very discerning look at how cigarettes came to be such a central part of American culture, rising from only a very peripheral presence and one disapproved by most of polite society into something that became a symbol of manhood, of camaraderie, much more acceptable for women, and then the long struggle to identify its health problems and the desperate fight of the tobacco industry to resist those scientific findings and to undermine them. And it's quite a story. Again, the book is called The Cigarette Century. It is published by Basic Books. And Professor Alan Brandt, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you very much.
I'm so glad that you've written this book. It's absolutely fascinating. I have to confess, I neglected to read your biography until just as I was announcing this interview. And I have to say, I am surprised and not surprised that you are a professor of medical history, because that's some of the most interesting stuff in the book about sort of that long, arduous process of tracking down the harmful effects of cigarettes and of proving it. But you write about it in a way that makes sense to an amateur like me. And I would have thought someone with all of your expertise that might have been a little bit of a challenge. You really made this very readable and accessible material.
Well, I'm really pleased to hear that, because that was certainly my goal. And I've always been interested in rooting medical history and the history of public health in broader history of American society and culture. And there's really no topic more central to that than the history of cigarette smoking and the health impacts that it's had in American society.
And the story of how, in your words, the cigarette came to be a central symbol of attractiveness, beauty, and power. You start the book, the introduction to it, with a really intriguing personal story about a famous sign.
Yes. When I was 7 years old, I went to New York City for the first time with my parents. And we were in Times Square, and there was a tremendous camel billboard above Times Square in which a camel man, a smoker, blew these perfect steam smoke rings into Times Square. And I thought that was just the most fantastic thing I'd ever seen. I wanted to know how it was done. And I realized later that the industry had really come to understand how to tap into the head of kids, which was really their crucial market.
Well, in particular, tapping into that idea of independence and autonomy, and maybe even what seemed at the time like a relatively mild rebelliousness. I mean, there were a whole lot of inner drives upon which the tobacco industry managed to capitalize.
Well, that's exactly right. And they really were brilliant marketers throughout the 20th century, especially in how to appeal to kids, how to utilize peer pressure, how to use advertising and public relations to make this a very attractive and appealing behavior.
Hmm. Going into this, how much of this history did you know?
Well, I knew what I think most of us knew. We'd all seen cigarette ads, and before 1970, heard them on the radio and saw them on the television. We all had seen how central smoking was in film and popular culture. And in a way, we all knew that we were told smoking's not good for you, and yet it was enormously popular. So those were the things that I knew. What I think I didn't know was just how meticulously imposed this was by an industry that understood human motivation, that understood that it had a highly biologically addictive product, and by an industry that would so aggressively deny the harms of the product that they had come to understand in their own laboratories.
Hmm. I want you to explain one line in your introduction. I mean, I have eventually come to discern what you're really talking about here, but it's, I think, of central importance. You say, following the cigarette through the century offers a fundamental opportunity to evaluate the contingent nature of historical change.
Well, that really is a key sentence, because one of the things I think that most historians agree is that it didn't have to be this way. And so I was really interested in those forces and those people that built this behavior in a very deliberate and careful and strategized approach. And so that's what I mean by contingent, is that we didn't have to have a tobacco industry that sold cigarettes to so many people with so many harms in the way that it did occur.
You also mentioned in the introduction, you call it one of the great ironies of modern corporate history, that we have come to know more about the internal operations of the tobacco industry than perhaps any other big business in the last century. And of course, that's partly because there have been some knockdown, drag-out fights involving the tobacco industry, and only, I'm sure, very reluctantly have they had to open themselves up for a certain kind of scrutiny that they, to this day, do not welcome, I'm sure. How did you end up gathering all that you did in terms of some of the inner workings of some of these tobacco companies and exactly what they did? How much of this is easily accessible public record, and how much of it did you have to go after quite aggressively?
Well, it's a really interesting question. When I first started working on the book, I talked to people in the tobacco industry, and they said they would not help me. And I wasn't really surprised, because this is an industry that was notoriously secretive insulated. But what happened was that as a result of people suing the industry, and very often people would sue and lose, they nonetheless began to chip away at getting some access to the internal documentation of the industry. And then some whistleblowers took documents out of the industry and made them public. And eventually, as a result of the litigation, literally millions of documents, the most secret documents, became available to the public. So I went from having no documentation about this industry to really having boatloads of secret papers. And it's a really sordid story. What these documents show is that the industry knew at a very early time that there were any number of carcinogens in tobacco smoke. They knew that filters did not make their products safe. And yet, all the while, the industry was developing strategies to deceive the American public. So it's a much more dramatic and moral story than I had really anticipated.
We're speaking with Professor Alan Brandt about his book, The Cigarette Century, The Rise, Fall, and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. You actually begin by talking about tobacco in general and the way in which tobacco shaped much of life on the North American continent. This is well ahead, of course, of the invention of cigarettes when tobacco was used in any number of other ways. But tell us how, in your words, the demands of tobacco cultivation shaped the character of the colonists.
Well, from the very early colonies, when Europeans began to cultivate tobacco, it was hard to grow, and it involved meticulous care through the season to evaluate the leaf, when to harvest it, how to cure it. And so tobacco growers became very much oriented towards their expertise and a sense of honor about what they were doing. And it really shaped early American politics. It shaped the revolutionary ethos of independent farming. It was a critical element in the crucial need for new labor, which led to the incorporation of slavery into the tobacco economy. And it was the major cash crop of the early colonies, sending tobacco back to England and to Europe. So partly what I wanted to show is that this is a product that has these deep roots in American culture and economy. And so in the 20th century, when the cigarette really takes off, it would be no simple matter to end the epidemic of disease associated with such a popular and lucrative product.
Hmm. It's an interesting history when we talk about cigarettes, in that you tell us cigarettes have actually, in fairly primitive form, existed for centuries, but that the thing that we would recognize as the modern cigarette is a little more recent invention.
Well, that's exactly right. And the cigarette as we know it was really invented in the last decades of the 19th century, when certain industrialists, especially James Buchanan Duke, fixed on the idea of mass technological rolling machines that could produce hundreds of thousands of cigarettes in a day. And then he had a problem. If I've now overproduced cigarettes, which were not that popular a product, how am I going to sell them? And he really innovated in terms of advertising, public relations, and marketing in ways that would become very characteristic of the 20th century, but in many ways that the tobacco industry actually invents around the turn of the 20th century.
Hmm. Yes, you say Duke understood that the solution to overcapacity, and that was created by, of course, this modern technology, which was making many, many, many more cigarettes than anyone at that moment in time could ever hope to smoke. Duke understood that the solution to overcapacity involved the aggressive solicitation of new smokers.
Well, that's right. And so many aspects of what today we've called our consumer culture was about this idea of production and then demand. And how are you going to create demand for products often which are marginal, ephemeral, like the cigarette?
Hmm. And just, it's just kind of an interesting little sidelight. You mentioned that as consumption of tobacco and cigarettes especially really increased, one of the things that needed to be developed was a safe and convenient mode of ignition.
Well, that's right. We didn't have safety matches really until the invention of the cigarette. And one of the technologies that the cigarette's success was dependent upon was the development of an easily carried matchbook that wouldn't ignite in your pocket. And so eventually, especially the Diamond Match Company perfects the idea of these non-toxic matches. And this is really the handmaiden of the cigarette in terms of its success.
Hmm. You say that from its inception, the cigarette targeted the uninitiated, young people for whom it was the first form of tobacco consumption. It was sort of like a starter set for tobacco, in a sense.
Well, I think that Duke and his early competitors in the tobacco industry knew that the most seasoned tobacco users might be pipe smokers and cigar smokers. In many places in the country, people chewed tobacco. So he really wanted a product that would appeal to youth. So, for example, Duke is one of the first people to utilize trading cards, and the earliest baseball cards are tobacco cards. And kids were encouraged, especially young boys, collect them all, get a full set. And this is an example of that tapping into a child's or adolescent's mentality. And many boys started smoking at the turn of the century so they could collect the entire league of baseball players.
Hmm. One of the most fascinating things about all this is the transformation of a large swath of the American populace that at one point felt one way about cigarette smoking and then came to release a lot of those prejudices. I mean, not everybody, but many, many Americans. You say that for a certain number of Americans, the cigarette around the turn of the century represented many of the evils already associated with alcohol, wastefulness, indulgence, a poison harmful to self and others. And you recount in your book much of the efforts of some of the same crusaders to limit alcohol and to limit cigarettes. How fascinating that it is the First World War, in many respects, that signals kind of a turnaround in American attitudes about the cigarette. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Well, I think you're exactly right. In 1880, about the worst thing that you could say about somebody is that they were indulgent and pleasure-seeking. And by the 1920s, I have many cigarette ads that say, indulge in a lucky strike, the most pleasureful cigarette. So partly what I'm arguing is that there was a transformation in American values and attitudes about leisure, about pleasure, about glamour and sexuality. And the World Wars in both instances played an important role. Many boys went off to fight in France as non-smokers, and they came back as regular smokers, very much committed to the cigarette. And then this was underscored and supported by advertising and marketing.
Hmm. I thought it was really interesting, especially you said that there'd been this campaign against cigarettes, but for our young soldiers fighting and dying and being maimed on the battlefields in that terrible First World War, that in light of what was occurring, it just seemed, in your words, prudish and completely out of step with the moment to be plucking cigarettes from the hands of these young soldiers. It seemed, in fact, even frivolous.
Well, I think that that's really right. And the cigarette's always been evaluated on the basis of its risks in a particular context. And so even though there was a strong moral opposition to giving soldiers cigarettes, in the face of this war, which was so violent and there were so many deaths, the idea of denying cigarettes seemed like a very stingy approach to supporting the troops. And in fact, General Pershing, who directs the First World War's military efforts, says tobacco is as important as bullets for the war effort and in maintaining the morale of the troops.
Hmm. And you mentioned that in that warfare experience, the camaraderie of war came to be symbolized in the sharing of a cigarette, a new commodity of morale. Well, the tobacco industry certainly pounces on this, in a sense, sort of newfound respectability for the cigarette. And one of the results of their aggressive marketing campaigns is the rise of national brands. And this is really one of the ways in which our cultural landscape is vastly reshaped from the way it had worked before.
Well, that's right. And again, the industry innovates to create national brands. It saw the economies of scale instead of having small regional markets with literally hundreds of brands, which had existed in the 19th century. really fixing on a single brand, hiring Madison Avenue advertising agencies to promote it, was really part of our culture moving from what have often been called island communities to really developing a single national consumer culture. Camel is one of the first major national brands. It's soon joined by Lucky Strikes from American Tobacco. And these brands went head-to-head in competing for American customers.
You talk of how tobacco began going after women consumers, although this was really, for a while at least, swimming upstream. But eventually that tide turned as well.
Well, that's right. This was a taboo that the industry was very eager to overcome because they understood after World War I, if they could only advertise directly to men, they would be missing half the potential market. So they really broke through this taboo by hiring public relations consultants and eventually moving towards the direct advertising to women, associating smoking with glamour, fashion, sexuality. And by 1930, the industry is aggressively pursuing this half of the market.
You tell us a little bit about some of those early ads that featured Amelia Earhart, or in an infamous case, opera star Madame Ernestine Schumann-Heink without her approval.
Right.
And you also tell about how one of the ways they marketed to women was to suggest tobacco as a substitute for candy, that it might even be more healthy than candy. And boy, they brought on themselves the wrath of the National Confectioners Association, you tell us.
Well, they were always just one step ahead. And this idea that smoking might be associated with thinness, and then also making thinness part of a cultural ideal for women. So we, of course, remember the Virginia Slims campaigns from the 1960s and 70s, but really this was an idea of the 1920s and 30s. So celebrities, endorsements, and all of these ideas of smoking in film and media were crucial to building the behavior in the early 20s.
Well, and to building this identity of national brands, although you talk of a study done in the 1940s, which really revealed that there was no discernible difference between these various brands of cigarettes, and yet there the American public was falling prey to this extensive and aggressive advertising and PR work, I mean, the likes of which the world had never seen.
Well, that's right. And people were very loyal to their brands. But when they were tested in blind tests, could you identify whether you were smoking a Camel or a Lucky Strike or an Old Gold? They found that most consumers actually couldn't identify their brands blindfolded. But they would say, I only smoke Old Golds. And this was really what the industry wanted to create, this kind of intensive brand identification, that the brand said something about the consumer.
You, of course, take us through some of the most interesting material in the book in the chapter called More Doctors Smoke Camels, in which we are told about the slowly dawning realization that there is the potential for terrible, terrible harm in tobacco and cigarettes specifically. And yet this is a long struggle for scientists to actually prove this, and the story of that struggle is really in part the story of what exactly science is.
Well, that's right. How do we know and how can we prove something? These are crucial elements in the history of the cigarette. And there was always concern on the part of physicians and the public about the health impacts of smoking. But it did take time to see the impacts in human beings, and there was a slow but steady, impressive rise of lung cancer from 1900 to 1940 that began to implicate the cigarette. And then researchers really began to demonstrate conclusively, certainly by the early 1950s, that in fact smoking caused lung cancer.
And of course, the tobacco industry is not about to take this lying down. You write of the new and unprecedented public relations strategy, which was, in a phrase, to disrupt the emerging consensus on the harms of cigarette smoking. What a great way to put it.
Well, that's right. The industry did everything it could to disparage and confuse what were emerging as major scientific findings of critical importance to the smoking public. And so they hired a public relations firm, they hired a lot of scientists, and they kept saying over and over again, there is no proof, there is no proof, we need more science. But now we understand, especially with the availability of the document, that this was perhaps the first major scientific disinformation campaign of the 20th century.
I thought interesting, especially you said the strategy of someone named Hill, who was one of the great strategists in this struggle, was for ending the hysteria, in quotation marks, by insisting that there were two sides to this. But just the fact that one calls the mounting concerns about cigarettes to brand it as hysteria was in and of itself a brilliant PR move.
Well, that's exactly right. And Hill was brilliant. And he understood that the best thing to say is don't deny that cigarettes cause disease. Say, we need to understand more. Let's calm down and be reasonable about this. Let's hear all sides. And like many other issues in modern science, this had a way of reassuring the public. Meanwhile, the industry starts to put filters on the cigarettes, filters that they know do not remove the carcinogens. And the American public, a decade later, is smoking more than ever in spite of the new science.
Hmm. Your book includes generous illustrations of much of the material that was used for advertising cigarettes, and in particular many which utilize the images of medical doctors, which is just a kind of a frightening thing. How close a parallel would you say we can draw between this struggle to understand this potential harm and, for instance, something like global warming? In some respects, it seems like an interesting parallel, maybe one that is not as close as we might be tempted to draw.
Well, I think it is an important analogy, because in the global warming debate, it's been, well, there's uncertainty. And what we understand about uncertainty is it leads to failures in public interventions, in legislation, in new strategies for control. So the industrial interests in uncertainty on global warming really borrowed a page from the tobacco wars and the debates about the harms of tobacco.
Hmm. A fascinating book and story. Again, the book is The Cigarette Century, The Rise and Fall and Deadly Persistence of the Product That Defined America. It's published by Basic Books. The author, Alan Brandt, Professor Brandt from the Harvard Medical School. Professor Brandt, I thoroughly enjoyed your book. I thought it was just incredibly fascinating, and I hope many people will seek it out and read it as I did. And I thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program features an interview that was recorded and initially broadcast way back in 2003.
We're going to be talking for the next few minutes on the Morning Show about a very thought-provoking book which examines the relationship between white America and black America and the way in which cultural sharing has gone on in some really perhaps somewhat surprising and unexpected ways, and the way in which, in particular, the black community views some of this crossover, and in some respects with a bit of alarm or even resentment. The book I'm talking about is called Everything But the Burden, What White People Are Taking from Black Culture. It is actually a collection of essays that approach this thought from various perspectives, and the book is edited by Greg Tate, who is a longtime staff writer at The Village Voice and has a number of literary works to his credit and some musical credits as well. as musical director of the well-known music ensemble Burnt Sugar. And we have Greg Tate for a few minutes to talk with us about this book called Everything But the Burden. Greg Tate, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You say in the introduction that this is admittedly a peculiar book about a peculiar fascination. Tell us why you were moved to say such a thing about your own book and about the topic it explores.
Well, the origins of the book are kind of peculiar in that the project was actually brought to me by two editors at Broadway, who are both white, who were both fascinated by the emergence of Eminem as a pop culture icon, and also by sightings of like young white kids at their suburban train stops wearing backwards baseball caps and baggy jeans and other forms of hip-hop regalia. And they thought there was a book in this, and I did too, certainly knowing, you know, kind of the history of the imitation of black performance styles in American culture that go all the way back really to the plantation and to minstrelsy and on up through, you know, a little closer to our time, you know, through the impact that, you know, rock and roll had on young Elvis Presley, and that the blues and R&B had on the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Eric Clapton and so forth. So, you know, what we wanted to look at was kind of how, you know, this whole kind of attraction-repulsion effect that's going on in terms of, you know, the black cultural contribution. I mean, the title comes from my mother, something I always heard her say, that, you know, white people want everything that black people produce but the burden of being black, you know. And
she wrote a poem of the same name,
right? She wrote a poem of the same name, you know. And, you know, it's kind of look at, you know, the book is a way of exploring this whole fascination that takes place inside of a culture of scorn and, you know, racial hatred and bestial treatment and the whole lot of it.
That's, what, of course, one of the points which I think is particularly interesting. When someone comes along and emulates certain cultural attributes,
right,
of the black community, do you feel, and the writers who share their thoughts in this book, do you feel that that is being done by people that otherwise feel, as you say, scornfully towards blacks, or isn't it being done by whites who happen not to feel that way?
Well, I think that it's one of those things that you look at in a multidimensional kind of way, because you know, I mean, if people hadn't unearthed some of say Elvis Presley's, you know, somewhat racially inflammatory comments, you know, in his history, I don't think that you know, there would have been quite the ire that some people feel towards Elvis Presley, because in fact, when he first was heard on the radio, he was played on black stations, and a lot of black people thought he was black and were surprised when he showed up at their, you know, in their town theaters to find out that, oh, this is a white guy, you know what I mean? But I mean, black audiences have always embraced white artists who they felt were really, you know, honoring, you know, their influence in a sense by bringing their artistry, you know, to the fore. But, you know, it also took place historically in a time, you know, if we look at, say, blues and rock and roll, it takes place in a time when, you know, black artists were really excluded from having the same opportunities in the marketplace that some of their, you know, kind of white inheritors had.
In your introduction, you quote someone, I can't remember now who it is, who posed the question, I think some time ago, but maybe you think the question is still worth asking, Why does everyone love black music, but nobody loves black people?
Right.
Who was that who posed that question?
It's actually a performance artist by the name of Roger Guinevere Smith, and he actually did a performance called Huey Newton for PBS that Spike Lee shot, you know, where he told the Huey Newton story. But in an earlier work, he had posed that question, and it always stuck with me because I think it kind of succinctly summed up, you know, some of the paradox that we're talking about today.
Right. You say elsewhere in the introduction of the book that this is a book about black resentment and discontent,
mm-hmm,
to no
and
small
envy,
extent.
And envy.
Right.
Right.
Now, one of the things I want to try to get a better handle of, because I have read the book to some extent, but
okay,
not really digested it to the extent that I want to. Are your various writers whose essays are collected here, do they, by and large, write from a perspective of resentment, or are they writing about others in the black community who resent this, what's called in some places, white piracy?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, as you go through the book, you see that it takes a lot of kind of left turns and odd angles in terms of looking at it. You know,
that's my sense, yeah.
Yeah, because some people write very personally. There's an incredible memoir in the book by a young writer named Cassandra Lane. It's called Skinned, where, you know, she talks about growing up in Louisiana. And, you know, Cassandra's a young woman, I mean, in her late 20s, you know. So, I mean, the experience she's talking about is really from the late 70s, early 80s. But it's the experience of having white playmates up until a certain point when their parents decided that she wasn't good enough to play with their children anymore. You know what I mean? And, you know, she deals with, like, the hurt, you know, and resentment that this kind of provoked in her towards white women. And, you know, the book, in the essay, she talks about how she realizes that she has a problem with black men being attracted to white women because of this childhood experience. You know, so that's like one very kind of raw personal response, you know, to the thematic of the book. And then, you know, there are other people who look at things in a much more academic kind of fashion, you know, almost. I mean, there's a woman named Renee Green in the book who really looks at the way race is represented in science fiction films, you know, and she spends a lot of time talking about a film with Charlton Heston called The Omega Man.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and she talks about also the novels of the black science fiction writer, Octavia Butler, you know, and how she deals with the slave experience in a science fictional kind of context, you know what I mean? But, you know, it's an attempt to really kind of look at this thing as broadly as possible in terms of the African-American response, you know. And so, I mean, writers emotionally are coming from a lot of different places, you know. And, I mean, Carl Hancock Rux's piece on Eminem, on one hand, you think it's maybe coming from this place of resentment, but what he's really talking about is how the need for black people to actually perform a stereotype of black culture is an oppressing thing in and of itself. The fact that black people have adopted this as an option in terms of how to respond to a racist context is a limiting thing in and of itself. So, you know, the writers take you on a lot of journeys in these essays.
Right.
You know, and it definitely take you a lot of places that, you know, I wasn't even expecting to go as an editor.
I suppose one of the parallels that maybe we could draw about this would be that it is perceived by some that taking on a like of black music and adopting certain black fashion styles and so on, and yet not necessarily embracing any blacks as friends,
right,
would be a little bit the same as if someone didn't mind their son playing with blacks on a basketball team,
sure,
but would really have a problem if he tried to bring them home with him, or if one of them wanted to date his daughter or something like that, that somehow that would cross a line. Is that a fair parallel?
I think so. I mean, I think that the mythology and the pathology that's developed around race in American culture and the denial of, you know, the history of slavery, you know, that has gone on as well, has got a lot of things twisted in a lot of people's mind about what's what in terms of, you know, cultural identity and cultural authenticity and cultural sharing and so forth. You know, I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, black, white, and otherwise, have a lot of confusion around their identity as Americans because of the way, how racially skewed, you know, the environment of the culture is, for one thing. You know, the fact that, you know, it's still such a heavily segregated society, you know, in terms of race, in terms of black and white, in terms of just where people live and how they interact socially.
Right.
You know what I mean? All these things have an impact in terms of perpetuating this mythology. Well, at the same time, I can turn on the television, you know, and go from channel to channel, and within like 2, 3, 4, 5 seconds, there's going to be, you know, a black iconic figure, a black musical reference, a black stylistic nuance, you know, portrayed there. You know, so you have this peculiar, again, to use that word, impression that's left by people being socially segregated, but then at the same time kind of culturally bombarded, you know, with you know, black archetypes and stereotypes.
So it's that's, I suppose, where this resentment comes from, and the fact that at least some blacks would like to, in some ways, maybe sort of hold some of this to themselves.
Well, I mean, I think people have such a broad number of responses to the thing. You know, somebody was asking me, you know, how do black people feel about Eminem? And, you know, I couldn't possibly speak for all black people, but, you know, among my friends, I have some people who are pretty politically militant who love Eminem and other people who can't stand it. You know what I mean? And it really just depends on, you know, how open-minded the person is to a certain extent and to what degree, you know, someone is willing to let go of, say, their feelings about racial oppression to accept, you know, someone purely as an artist, you know, regardless of the racial context in which he operates.
Right. I'm reminded of a line of dialogue from an episode of ER with the head of the nurses, who is African-American. I can't think of her name now, but in a conversation with another staffer at the hospital where something has come up, and the sense was that this was sort of sparked by maybe latent racism. And the one character who is white says, you know, this was not about race. And this African-American nurse replies, with us, it's always about race.
Right.
It's easy for you to say, but for us, it's always about race. And I suppose that's part of what we're talking about is that mindset that views everything that happens on racial terms.
Well, you know, I mean, it's inevitable. You know what I mean? Because it's, you know, I mean, a Jasper, Texas happens. You know, an Amadou Diallo happens. So, you know. You know, in some senses, you know, that a lot of us kind of drop our guard, and then, you know, these kind of bestial incidents of racial violence occur that have such a pronounced history in terms of racial interaction in American society. But as well, you know, a friend of mine used to say that, you know, to be black in this country is to always affirm something, you know, and what he meant by that was, you know, you have a people who were designated incapable of living with whites and incapable of intellectual development by, you know, one of the founders of the country. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, you know, I mean, who's, you know, some of whose statements on race, I mean, would make, you know, Trent Lott look like a racial progressive.
Yeah.
You know, by comparison.
Right. It's,
you know,
very, I mean, striking to read, yeah, some of those Jefferson quotations that you include.
You know, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I mean, his racial paranoia was, you know, in some ways beyond comparison.
For one thing, Jefferson seems to have believed that blacks were incapable of profound thought.
Exactly. You know, and this was even in the face of receiving letters from the great mathematician and engineer and architect Benjamin Banneker and from the great poet and philosopher Phyllis Wheatley, you know, in his own time. You know, I mean, this is someone who, even in the face of contrary evidence, you know, simply couldn't accept that, you know, he really felt that black people would be too resentful of whites after the slave experience. You know, it's this incredible projection of guilt, you know, and paranoia onto another people,
right,
you know, that really were more a reflection of what was going on in his head, you know what I mean? But, I mean, a lot of that has to do, you know, when you know that kind of history, you know what I mean, and you know that, you know, some of the most offensive ideas about race come from people who are educated, highly placed in the society, highly influential in the society as well.
There are 18 essays in this book, and we are treated to all kinds of different takes on this question, including a chapter about Eminem, as you said, a chapter about pimps, a chapter about thugs. One particularly fascinating essay, I think, talks about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman.
Right.
and Norman.
Yeah, Tony Green.
Yeah. And the contrast, for instance, between Ali and Foreman, and what that says about different essays. What do we learn from drawing those kind of fascinating comparisons?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, Tony Green, who wrote that essay, is a writer as well as a former athlete, you know, and he read Norman Mailer's White Negro essay early on. And as he says, you know, some of the things that, you know, Mailer, some of the assumptions he makes about black culture in that book are just outrageous, but he almost feels like somebody had to go there just to break the ice in terms of the way white people read black people and black people's effect on white, you know, on white culture, white society, and so forth. You know, but he also goes on to say that he feels that some of Mailer's writing on boxing, you know, came the closest to anything he'd ever read to the experience of being an athlete on the field. You know, so Tony's coming from a place of great appreciation for Mailer. But, you know, if you see the film When We Were Kings, you know, you see Norman Mailer and George Plimpton in the film kind of going back and forth over the psychology of Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. And it's just, it's almost like hysterical to see, you know, these two literary lions trying to probe inside the psyches of these two black men who have pretty much been sent to Africa to beat each other's brains.
Right.
You know what I mean? And finding that for all their powers of erudition and psychoanalysis, they can't figure out either one of these guys, what they're really about.
Yeah, they don't, you know, come, I mean, particularly,
like,
close.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And, you know, so in a way, Tony's piece is almost like a send-up of watching these two guys kind of tear their hair out, trying to understand these two black athletes. You know, at the same time, you know, he's just talking about how, you know, as a young black man, he identified more with Foreman than with Ali, you know, because he was a stocky kind of guy, you know, and not that fast on his feet. You know, people made assumptions about him as an athlete, too, you know what I mean? And that's, you know, that's kind of typical of the way this book kind of rings changes, you know, in theme and variation, you know, out of the topic.
Right.
You know? And
we have just a minute or so, but I wanted to get a sense of, did these essays already exist or did you assemble them?
No, they're, except for the Hilton House piece on Richard Pryor and
yes.
the Mafia Diawara essay about the impact of, you know, soul music on youth in Mali in Africa in the 1970s. They're all original essays.
Very good. And you hand chose these writers, and
yes.
did you give them their topics, or did you set them free to explore what they wanted to?
I did. For the most part, I gave them their topics. A few rebelled and kind of came back with their own. And then there were, you know, in the piece of the instance of the Cassandra Lane essay, another one of my writers who was her professor, writer Mary Dankwa, who wrote about kind of the impact of Michael Jackson's kind of skin bleaching on black people in Ghana.
Yes.
You know, she had Cassandra Lane send me her essay, and I said, oh, this is great. It's got to be in the book.
Right. It is. Yeah. It's a fascinating kaleidoscope of various voices and perspectives. The book, again, is called Everything But the Burden, What White People Are Taking from Black Culture. Greg Tate has edited it. The book is published by Broadway Books. Greg Tate, really interesting to talk with you and very interesting to read this book. I thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we look forward to the monthly visit of Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, talking about a number of issues of concern, including the recent death of 99-year-old Prince Philip and the deterioration of relations between the United States and Russia. On Thursday's Morning Show, a look at at a grant which will allow mental health professionals to ride along with some police officers and be on site for certain situations.